You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take your calls on some of your favorite recipes from your childhood and what makes them so special for you. First, between now and the November 6th general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time or The Morning Show. You'll be able to find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we talked to Republican businessman Jay Schrader. He's running for Secretary of State, challenging Democratic incumbent Doug La Follette. Jay Schrader, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been asking candidates to give a short pitch for why voters should elect them. Why should you be the next Secretary of State of Wisconsin?
Because I have an interest in the office. Initially, to get to be on the ballot, you need to have 2,000 signatures. And when I talk to people, I've had Democrats, Independents, and Republicans sign my nomination papers. And the overwhelming thing that they want is just to have term limits on this position. The current office holder has held the office for 40 years. And overall, in all parties, or people that sign my papers, they want that as my number one goal.
There was talk about getting rid of the office of the Secretary of State. A lot of its responsibilities have been moved to other parts of the state government. What are your thoughts on the existence of this job?
Well, that was for the state treasurer, but these are constitutional officers. I'm supposed to be a public servant. The people have spoken and said, we want to put these offices to work. I want to do that. The number one goal after term limits is to work on eliminating voter fraud in the state of Wisconsin. Because according to the McIver Institute, there was 4,000 cases in the 2016 election.
So how would you use the role of Secretary of State, which currently doesn't really do anything with elections? How would you see yourself using that role when it comes to voting?
Well, in the United States of America, the overwhelming majority of Secretary of States are involved in elections. So I would use that as a precursor to talking to the legislature and governor to say, okay, the majority of the states have that. Let's have that in Wisconsin. Give me statutory authority, or even in addition, sit on the election commission. It's going to be a full-time job doing that. And what's important about that is when you have a fraud vote, that negates your or my vote. And that's why we need to make sure they're all legitimate.
Now, some of the former responsibilities of the office that have been removed from its mandate include licensing of corporations, notary services, the authority to publish bills signed into law. The list goes on. Would you want to see some of those jobs restored to the Office of Secretary of State?
Well, those duties, it's been taken away from the current office holder, Mr. La Follette, by a bipartisan, I believe. He likes to take on or mention that Governor Walker and Governor Thompson took the duties away, but he never mentions that Jim Doyle and the Democrats were in majority in between. So bipartisan, I believe, they don't believe that he could handle those duties. For me, though, my number one focus, well, like I said, term limits, but the voter registration, something to really get our money's worth out of. The salary is $70,000 a year. We have to have someone in there to work. An example of me working is I've driven 22,000 miles in the state of Wisconsin since January. I want to show that I have an interest in the office and I want to work. And that should demonstrate once I'm elected that I would work as well. Now, my opponent, I go around, I see county fairs, Lincoln Day dinners and that, and I don't believe he's left Dane County in the last 12 months, which if you want to serve, you got to be willing to go out and see the people. That's what to be a servant.
Talking to Republican businessman Jay Schrader. He's running for Secretary of State, challenging Democratic incumbent Doug La Follette. So some of what you want to do would involve working, as you mentioned, with the legislature and or the governor to restore or add new responsibilities to the job. One possibility is that there could be Republicans in charge of some parts of the government, Democrats in charge of others. Do you see yourself as being able to work with people from both parties to make these kind of changes you're hoping for?
Sure, because going around the state, I'm very clear on what I want for the duties, and either party should be willing to help me and empower me to do those duties. The interesting thing I have had on my Facebook page, Democrats say they're going to vote for me because they want somebody that's actually going to get the office working. You know, their duties are very few, and it's kind of laughing, or somebody said, you know, the Secretary of State's office is a joke. But the sad part of it is I think my opponent is probably the only one laughing because his pension is going to be $280,000 a year, $23,000 a month. Now, we have to have somebody in there that wants to work and not only see their duty as to collect a paycheck.
You've mentioned the idea of a two-term limit. Assuming that didn't take effect by law, by the time you were done with office, would you pledge not to run for re-election if you had served out two terms?
I would not run for re-election, period. But that goal, like I said, all the parties, I believe, or the voters have told me, get this done. And as I had said before, I'm using this as a crystal clear what I want to do. So then when I go to the legislative committees properly saying, hey, I ran on these planks, let's get this implemented. Because this office has failed for 40 years, and we need to have it changed. And term limits is one of the big step to correcting it.
And do you see a role for the Secretary of State as in some ways a bully pulpit or a way to publicize issues, even if they're not directly under the legal set of responsibilities of the office? And if so, what kind of issues would you focus on?
Yes, it could be, because I've had to go through all the counties and, like I'd said, the 22,000 miles that I've driven to demonstrate that. Any issue that comes up or businesses. I also would like to sit on the Wisconsin Economic Commission. The unique thing, though, I'll mention about these duties and what I want to do, and it's unique that I'm not aware of anywhere else has, is I would like to have the duties put in for the term of office. So if I'm elected, in the enabling statute, you have the duty for 4 years. At the end of my term, those duties expire. So if I would run and win re-election, or someone else would win, they have to, quote, reapply for those duties. That way, we will get this office functioning, and you have to, it's pay for performance. If you don't perform, you don't have the duty. But that's a way to work and demonstrate that you want to do something and accomplish it. Because right now, it's kind of sad. It's not a functioning. The office is like a bear in the winter. It's in hibernation.
Can you talk a little bit about your biography, your resume a little bit, and how you feel it would qualify you for this job?
Sure. Well, one of the things, what qualifies me is the effort I put in initially just to running for the office. The second thing is my education. I have an associate degree in applied science in real estate. Why is that important? Because the Secretary of State sits on a board of public lands, state of Wisconsin. There's 77,000 acres that the state is in charge of. With a real estate degree and background, that would help in that, getting the most out of our land or putting it to work as best as possible. And I have a business administration degree from UW-Stout. So the work ethic, the educational background, and the reason or wanting to make something function, I think you put those all together and it can help out.
Well, early voting is going on now. We're exactly 1 week out for Election Day. Anything else you want voters to know about you and the office before we let you go?
I'm a hard worker. In the mortgage business, I drove 1.2 million miles going around refinancing people. Running for office is kind of the same thing. I'm going all over the state. But the thing I want to get across is the people I meet, they're happy people. They like the state of Wisconsin. They like our country. And they just want it to have it the way it is. But if everyone would think of this and check out my webpage, Schrader for Wisconsin, check it out, my Facebook page, Jay Schrader for Secretary of State. And I'd appreciate if they can consider voting for me on November 6th.
Jay Schrader, thanks for joining us today.
Yep, thank you.
Businessman Jay Schrader is the Republican candidate for Wisconsin's Secretary of State. Democrat Doug LaFollette, the incumbent Secretary of State, joined us yesterday. Between now and the November 6th general election, WPR has invited candidates who are running in these contested races for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time or The Morning Show. There is a big roster of interviews now. You can find them at wisconsinvote.org. One note, Central Time reached out to U.S. Senate candidates Tammy Baldwin, the Democratic incumbent, and Leah Vukmir, the Republican challenger. Neither was able to join us for an interview in this series of candidate interviews. Coming up, we want to know what the most memorable recipes of your childhood were, your foods that you grew up with, for better or worse. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stay with us. We'll hear your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A lot of us have memories of food that was special to us when we were little. Maybe one of your parents made your favorite scrambled eggs, or maybe a special meatloaf from grandma. Well, we want to hear about those recipes and those memories. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What foods, what recipes are memorable from your childhood? Do you have a memory of eating it with your family growing up? What makes the recipe so special to you? And now that you've grown up, maybe do you share it with your own kids or your, I don't know, grandkids? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Go right to your calls. Luke is with us in Delavan. Luke, hi. Ha, we lost Luke. That was a weird sound. Thanks for calling in, Luke. We'll go now to Carrie in New Glarus and hope for better luck. Carrie, hello. Oh, this does. Oh, there you are. Hi, Carrie. What food did you want to tell us about?
Well, I grew up with a family of, there was six of us, and my mom always made, it was called chow mein hot dish. And so it was a typical Midwest hot dish with rice and hamburger and chopped up celery. And it was not my favorite, but she always thought it was our favorite.
Oh, no.
And she made it all the time. Because it was inexpensive.
Sure. And so, did you pretend to like it to make her happy?
I did. There were so many times I stuck the pieces of celery under my plate. But, yes.
And now is this something... Have you gone back and tried to recreate this, Carrie, and maybe zest it up a little bit?
I don't even know how to zest it up. She used cream and mushroom soup.
Yum.
Yes, I know. It was a typical, hot dish. So, but yes, I do like to make, stir fry and stuff like that. But I never could quite get the taste of that that chow mein hot dish out of my mouth. So,
Carrie, thanks a lot for starting us off. I appreciate that at 800-642-1234. I don't know. I think I'd kind of like that, me. But Margaret is up next in Milwaukee. Margaret, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. When I was growing up, my family owned an apple orchard in Michigan, and we would pick a ton of apples. I have six brothers and sisters, and make applesauce. Our favorite thing to eat it was we would have macaroni and cheese and applesauce.
Mix them together?
Not exactly.
Okay, good.
Now, as an adult, I might put some applesauce on my fork and also some macaroni and cheese, but I don't mix them.
I got to ask, Margaret, eating applesauce now, I'm going to guess it's not the same as the applesauce that you ate that you knew was apples you just picked out of the family orchard. Am I right?
Well, nowadays, I make my own applesauce now. I continue that tradition. I go up to Barcel Fruit Farm and I get a ton of apples in the fall. And I continue to make applesauce, but it doesn't taste the same as store-bought. It's thicker. It's not as sweet usually because there's no sugar added. And I think it's delicious.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Margaret. We're asking for your food memories, the foods you remember as a kid growing up eating. Ones you loved, ones you didn't like so much, or the memories attached to them. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We asked around WPR. Lisa from our Milwaukee Bureau said when she was four, her grandma would make her Armenian coffee at 5 in the morning. She has a vague memory of sitting at their kitchen table drinking the incredibly strong and heavily sweetened coffee. Grandparents give interesting things to their kids. I don't know. It must have been a little jazzed up from that coffee. I remember my grandparents sometimes giving me a little bit of Pabst when I was probably three or four. Don't try this at home. Back to your calls now. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. What a great subject. What comes to mind for me is my grandparents or my grandmother was always baking. And one of the things that I had the fondest memories of was her homemade raised donut.
Ooh.
And all the baking there. I mean, she had refrigerator. She was always baking. But, hearing the last caller talk about the applesauce, it reminded me, hers was always pink in color, and it was almost like cream. I don't know, you can store bought, and I don't know why it was pink in color, but I wish I had these recipes, because I'd love to make them. But those are just some of the fondest memories of meals.
And you remember the smell of the glazed donuts in the house?
Well, they're not glazed. They were just sugared.
Sugared donuts.
But they were raised donuts. They weren't cake donuts.
Okay.
So they had yeast in them. And, God, I just there's never been a store-bought one as good.
Huh. Randy, thank you so much for sharing that story. Now I want donuts, too. Back to your calls. Diane is with us in Menominee Falls. Diane, hello.
Hey. I'm calling with two cultural backgrounds that were different. My mother was from Russia, and she made an out-of-this-world oxtail vegetable soup with dumplings. And that oxtail would just cook all day long, simmer and simmer and simmer. And it just had the most wonderful, meaty flavor. You'd never think oxtails could taste so good, but they did. And then my grandparents, they were from Sweden. So every year at this time, we'd make homemade potato sausage. So it's got meat in it, but it's got a lot of potato and seasoning with allspice. And my grandfather would always make homemade herring. And there's just nothing you can compare to the homemade herring. And grandma would always make Swedish pancakes. So those are my memories.
Oh, what a great combination, Diane. Thanks for sharing those. We heard from Neil on Facebook who says his mom was a vegetarian in the 1950s and 60s, so they would eat homemade gluten steaks and his grandma's carrot roast. I mean, that's ahead of the time. I mean, there are gluten steaks now you can buy in freezer sections at stores, but they must have had to be pretty creative at coming up with that. And our own reporter Danielle Kading replied in all caps when we asked, said, "Tater tot hot dish." She said it was at all the community potlucks and church gatherings growing up. Let's go back to your calls now. We are asking for your food memories, foods you remember as a kid, the memories attached to them, and whether you liked them or not. Carol joins us now from Appleton. Carol, hi.
Hi. Yes, I want to let you know about a recipe my mom used to make. It was a German dish, and she called it Potage, I guess it was the name. But it has, in a pressure cooker, you put spare ribs, chunks of potato, and then sauerkraut, and then you cooked it. And it was so good. You walked in the house, and you heard that pressure cooker, you know what you're having for supper.
Oh, that's great. Now, is this something you grew up and made yourself then, Carol?
I have, yes. Not as good as my mother's, but I have tried.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Yeah, I love that combination. I'd come over for dinner for that. Ribs, sauerkraut, and potatoes. Hard to go wrong. Now we'll go to Heather in Madison. Heather, hi.
Hi there. I have a follow-up to Randy. Randy was talking about an applesauce that was pink.
Oh, yeah.
Very much. And I know exactly what he's talking about and what apple it is. And grandmother made it with just apples and with the skins on and water. My mother-in-law makes the same thing. It's absolutely amazing. And I hunted and pecked to find out what kind of apple they were using. Sent it to the UW. And actually is a snow apple. It's a precursor to the Macintosh. And it is absolutely amazing. Best stuff on the planet.
Great. Wonderful. And do you make it now to this day, Heather?
I actually do. My mother-in-law gave me my own sieve and tamper. And I have to tell you, I liked it much better when she gave it to me prepackaged. just because it's a lot of work, but I now make it just because it's worth it. I look forward to the fall and getting those apples from their tree and making it myself.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that, Heather, and for solving the pink applesauce part of the equation. Back to your calls. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you got for us for food?
I've got a list for you, but my absolute top favorite has always been sauerbraten when it was our birthdays. Yeah. Five of us, my mother would let us choose what we wanted for dinner, and it was a 2 to 3 day marinade, and she'd make sauerbraten and dumplings, although I like it better with mashed potatoes, and then she'd also serve it with a sweet and sour coleslaw that was no mayonnaise. And then I remember her applesauce, and the one time my dad would venture into the kitchen to help her would be pickles and relish, pickle relish.
Oh, yeah, I'm there. Sauerbraten I didn't grow up with, but I love it. I love pickles. I love your relish. My mouth's watering. How about you, Mike?
Yeah, well, it was as soon as I got on the phone.
All right. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Let's go to Ron now in Oconto. Ron, hi.
Hello there.
What do you got for us, Ron?
An odd thing. A lady and I were talking, and she mentioned making a Jell-O salad with olives in it. And then she went on, and she said she also adds celery. And then, talking further, she said she puts mayonnaise on the top of it. And it's from a cookbook from the 50s. And so she's going to bring some. She makes it for Thanksgiving. She's going to bring some to a public place and make me eat it because she's afraid I'll take it home. I'll throw it away. And
she's going to watch you. She wants you to wants to witness this.
Yeah, it's made with lemon or lime Jell-O, and she puts all that stuff in it. And Yeah.
We're all pulling for you, Ron. Good luck with that. I will go to Jim now in Edgerton. Jim, hi.
Hi. Yeah. So my great grandmother moved here from Greece, and we grew up with these fabulous Greek plates. And one of my favorites was spanakopita, which is spinach with wrapped in feta dough with feta cheese. Yeah. It's one of my favorites. And my kids, actually, my oldest daughter, who's in college, just texted me a little while ago saying she made it last night. So. It has carried on.
You're passing it through the generations. That's great, Jim. Yeah, again, not a food I grew up with, a food I love now. Paul joins us now in Milwaukee. Paul, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What food do you have for us, Paul? What's your food memory?
It would be my mom's homemade spaghetti sauce. I mean, it wasn't like she started with tomatoes. She's canned, but, you know, she always found a way to make the celery crispy, and to this day, I do the same.
That sounds great, Paul. Thanks a lot for sharing that. We heard from more of our coworkers, Colleen Leahy with The Morning Show, the box stovetop stuffing. She asked for it on her birthday. John Gatto, an Italian dish called bagna calda, a fondue-type dipping sauce. I never had this. Anchovies, garlic, and cream. Okay, I'm in. And we heard on Facebook, Deborah, a British family, Yorkshire pudding and roast beef. And Lisa wrote on Facebook that puppy chow stuff, you know, that mix of stuff you put in a plastic bag and just munch. Well, you can keep sharing your food memories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Thanks so much to everybody who called in. We got more on the line. Noah in Richland Center has a mac and cheese memory. Charlene in Trumbull has a swamp. That's spaghetti with ground beef and veggies. Keep sharing your food memories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Me, I got my grandma's homemade kielbasa. Yeah. My mom, I love when she made meatloaf, especially because I could have meatloaf sandwiches with barbecue sauce the next day. Yeah, that takes me back. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Early last week, two African-American shoppers were killed in an apparent hate crime in Kentucky. One witness said the alleged shooter told him he wouldn't shoot him because, quote, whites don't shoot whites, end quote. Then news broke that nearly 14 explosive devices had been sent to prominent Democrats and their supporters, including former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. And on Saturday, 11 people were killed, six more injured, when an attacker opened fire at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Before the attack, the perpetrator had posted on the social media site Gab, threatening a Jewish humanitarian group aiding refugees. Our next guest is here to talk about the events of the last week and whether political and extremist violence is on the rise in the United States. Brian Levin is a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Brian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. I always enjoy being on your show. Thank you so much.
And Brian, I just listed those three events, horrible events, over the last week. Is it fair to talk about them together? Do you see these as isolated incidents or part of some wider phenomenon, wider trend we're seeing?
Oh, no, I think there's a wider trend. And just breaking news today that there was a standoff involving an anti-government critic that just ended. So it's almost like an increasing stream of this kind of stuff that's going on. Certainly in the last week, it's been just almost unprecedented.
Now, there are a lot of people, regardless of their political persuasion, angry about what's happening in the United States or the world. The vast majority of them, of course, don't act violently on their frustration. What is it? Do we know what it is that drives people to take that step and turn toward violent actions, a threat, a mailed pipe bomb, a shooting?
That is such a great question. And we have more foundational, incremental kind of changes, but then we also have catalytic events that kind of can stir people up. Can I give you an example?
Sure.
November 2016, election month, was the worst month for hate crime going back to the first anniversary of 9/11. And that's something that my colleagues, Jim Nolan, Kevin Grisham, and John Reitzel found with me when we were studying and disaggregating FBI data. So we've also found the day after Election Day, we had an anti-Muslim bomb plot, in Kansas. And the day after Election Day, November 10th, 2016, was the worst day for hate crime going back to June 2003. So we're starting to see some kind of seasonality a bit with hate crime around catalytic events. And these events can include anything from a terror attack to a police use of force or a conflictual election.
I want to focus in particular to this weekend's shootings at a synagogue in Pittsburgh. This happens amid a backdrop, if I'm reading the statistics right, of a big increase in anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish hate incidents. Can you talk about that, Brian?
Yeah, sure. We actually have seen a decline over the past 10 years. If you look at 2008, for instance, we had over 1,000 anti-Semitic hate crimes in the United States. 2016 marked a year where we saw some back-to-back increases. Anti-Semitic hate crimes, according to the FBI, bottomed in 2014 and then went from the low 600s to the high 600s, to 684. Since then, the Anti-Defamation League has found a 57% increase in hate incidents. These include both hate crimes, but most of them are non-criminal incidents. Interestingly enough, within this rise, they saw a decline in assaults, which is good news. Here's what I think's going on. If you look with respect to anti-Semitism, Jews are the most warmly regarded faith group in the United States. Yet we saw some increases in hate crime. One other thing, we've seen an increase in anti-Semitic content on the darkest corners of the web. Andrew Thompson did some great research on 4chan, which we've been fortunate enough to use. It depends on what you're looking at. But the bottom line is, I think we have several things, and just bear with me, with specific regard to the anti-Semitism. Over the past 50 years, we have a decline in confidence in the communal institutions which held us together, and this kind of anti-elitism wave which is coming in. At the same time, we see breathtaking demographic changes in the United States. White Christians are no longer a majority. And then we have, in addition, these catalytic events of which I spoke and the emergence of white nationalism. One last thing. I am not calling the president a racist or anything like that. I will leave others to analyze that. But here's what I do know has happened. For the first time in decades, white nationalists have found someone that they believe is speaking their message. And we've seen increased activity by these people, whether it's public demonstrations, which have then ebbed and flowed a little bit post-Charlottesville. But we've seen a fragmentation of these hate groups. So that hornet's nest is broken, but these lone wolf hornets are flying around, and they're directed by this horrible bigotry that can be found increasingly in our incivil political discourse.
Talking to Brian Levin from the Center for Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino about recent acts of political violence. Brian, talk a little more about the internet. We hear talk of people being radicalized by ISIS on the internet when it comes to extremist domestic violence, domestic terrorism here in the United States. Do you see an analogy there?
I really do. The only thing I would say is, one of the things that everyone has to understand about extremism, you're most likely to have an extremist act who lives kind of where you live. So, I asked Gary LaFrie, who's head of the University of Maryland's terrorism program, the Global Terrorism Database, and I said, what are some things that you've noticed? And what he told me is he said, people are acting in their region where they live. So that's something. And I think what we've seen with the internet, just like with our sociopolitical landscape, has been a change. And that is this fragmentation. So not only has the organization of these hate groups changed, where they're becoming leaner and meaner, and sometimes really more loners who are less joiners of hate groups than followers of their message. And as we have this fragmentation, the risk increasingly from these loners or small groups that are increasingly violent, we've seen an escalation in violence in recent weeks, that's a very dangerous conundrum, and it's very similar to what we've seen with, for instance, Daesh. When Al-Qaeda, when bin Laden was killed, he was upset that these kind of like loners who were inspired but not trained were taking the helm. And I think we're kind of seeing that here in the United States with regard to the most ascendant form of extremism right now, which is far right wing, but we're seeing a rising tide that is lifting many ships, but the most ascendant is the far right wing, and the loners, duos, or small autonomous cells within those groups are ones we have to look at as well.
Talking to Brian Levin right now, professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. He's with us to talk about the apparent rise in political violence lately in the United States and what might be behind it and how to turn it around. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the events over the last week, the pipe bomb mailings, the shootings, apparently hate motivated in Kentucky, and of course at the synagogue in Pittsburgh over the weekend? What steps do you think we should take to prevent this kind of violence? What do you want to hear from leaders, political and otherwise? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about an apparent rise in political violence and extremism in the United States. Brian Levin is with us, professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions to the events over the last week, your questions for our guest. Call in at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Brian, before we go to our callers, we have such a small sample size, in effect, for people who turn to this kind of political violence. Do we know, are there things out there that can turn down the temperature, prevent these kind of attacks before they happen?
You know, that's a great question. The more, what we found, at least with our study of hate crime, for instance, some events are going to just generate hateful violence. So, for instance, after a terror attack, or if there's some kind of conflictual event in society, we can often see these spikes. But here's the interesting thing. In some but not all circumstances, and just bear with me on this, some but not all circumstances, we've seen an increase in hate crime, for instance, after divisive political rhetoric, particularly by leaders, is well publicized. So give an example, just real quick. When candidate Trump launched his campaign and made those derisive comments about Mexicans, believe it or not, hate crimes in the next week against against Latino Americans actually went down. And similarly, a Republican debate in Detroit, when there were some off-the-cuff, not sustained, but not very pleasant comments about Muslims, hate crimes against Muslims didn't go up. However, when the Syrian refugee issue came up and was hitting the airwaves, there was an increase. And then when candidate Trump, who by then was already nearing front-runner status, held a town hall that was covered nationally in New Hampshire, hate crimes against Muslims did go up. Similarly, when he proposed his first Muslim ban 5 days after the San Bernardino terrorist attacks, hate crimes against Muslims spiked above and beyond the spike that we saw from the terror attacks. Conversely and lastly, when President Bush spoke of tolerance 6 days after 9/11, hate crimes dropped by two-thirds the next day and two-thirds in the following year. And then with regard to Latinos, which we spoke about earlier, we saw double-digit percentage increases not in 2015 with the campaign launch, but in 2016. And anti-Muslim hate crimes in that time of this political season, from, let's say, 2014 to 2016, hate crimes against Muslims in the United States, according to the FBI, went up 99%.
I want to turn to a caller now. Jim joins us in Slinger. Jim, hello.
Hello. Hey, I think your guest is full of garbage. He's just trying to raise this narrative how the right, just after only a few little incidents, this whole bomb-making incident on the DNC, it's completely ridiculous. Those bombs weren't even meant to go off. We don't even know the mental state of this guy. A few little incidents that happened, and here's your guest trying to equate the conservative right to, like, ISIS.
Jim, thanks for the call. Brian, what do we know about statistics of attacks in the United States by different sources, left, right, or Muslim extremist Islam-inspired?
Well, opinions are great, but facts are better. And one of the things that we've seen, by the way, let me just say, we have seen instances of threats and violence involving the left. There are well over 100 threats against the president on various platforms like Twitter, for instance. So he's right with that respect. There was a firebombing of a truck a couple of weeks ago up in the Pacific Northwest and a shooting at a Republican political establishment. But nevertheless, if you look at a whole sorts of data from the Global Terrorism Database or the accounting office with respect to the federal government, as well as our internal data, what we have found is far right, and I'm not talking about conservative people of goodwill, and I'm glad he pointed that out, but far right extremism is ascendant, and there have been more events involving far right extremists by a long shot than the left in recent years. But here's an important point. As one type of extremism goes up, a retaliatory or antagonistic type of extremism, which will oftentimes be imitative and escalative, will join it. But right now, there's no expert in our field who would suggest that far-right wing extremism is not occurring in greater numbers than with respect to left-wing.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Willem in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I think the last caller is kind of a clear example in a way of how, at what level the supporters of Donald Trump are willing to excuse these acts, like sending what, fake bombs is okay? I mean, and that's not even clear whether they were fake bombs. The man from the FBI said these were not a hoax. And the president has called for violence on many occasions. Carry him out. In the old days, we used to carry him out in a stretcher, you know, knock him out. I'll cover your legal bills, calling his opponents evil, bad people, enemies of the people. I mean, his rhetoric is clear on this issue. David Duke said he's our president. When the horrible events in Charlottesburg, he said there were good people on both sides. I don't think there is such a thing as a good Nazi. I'm sorry.
Willem, thanks for the call. Brian, are there things you'd want to hear from this president or any president after attacks like the ones in Pittsburgh and these pipe bombs?
Yes, I'd like to see the rhetoric toned down and a sustained disassociation from these hate groups and hate movements. Look, Bob Dole, Ronald Reagan, John McCain, all these folks decried prejudice. The traditional Republican Party did not have the kind of support that the alt-right and far-right hate world has given to President Trump. I want to be clear here. I am not saying that he's a bigot. That's for others to analyze. But what I am saying is the one thing that this movement lacked was a consistent message that was socio-politically acceptable in some degree that would have been parroted by a mainstream leading political candidate. And we really haven't seen anything like that since the 1968 election when George Wallace carried 5 states and got 44 electoral votes. The bottom line is we have an offender who sent bombs to numerous people that were listed as enemies of the president, and we also had an attack on a synagogue, the worst terrorist attack against Jews in American history, by someone who combined his disdain for Jews with his political and racist opinions about Latinos.
And we'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thanks to Brian Levin, professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. This year, Wisconsin Public Radio is going beyond the ballot, asking people around the state what issues are important to them this election season. Kyla Calvert-Mason reports that people see taxes as a big part of the way that government can have an impact on their lives.
When WPR reporters asked voters across the state about something government had done to help them, several people recalled a check they received this summer when Governor Scott Walker's administration turned a revenue surplus into a $100 per child tax refund. Amber Hatcher DeSayu lives in Onalaska, outside La Crosse.
Governor Walker just signed that tax credit, you know, that $100 tax credit per child. It's something small, but for so many families, especially in our community, that $100 is the difference between making it or not that one time.
Brian Kovalkuski lives in the small town of Shawano in northeastern Wisconsin.
I did get $100 in tax rebate for having a child this year.
Steve Lord Sr. of West Bend in southeastern Wisconsin is a Walker supporter.
Especially like what he's done with taxes and lowering property taxes.
Dwayne Zimmerman agrees. He lives in Monroe, a town near the Illinois border.
Something that's been good in our state is holding the line on taxes and tax decreases in some case, but especially property tax.
So it's no surprise that Walker and his Democratic challenger, Tony Evers, have spent a lot of their time this campaign season focused on taxes. In one of Evers' latest commercials, he's promising to redirect one of Walker's signature tax cuts for farmers and manufacturers to middle-class families.
As governor, Tony Evers will cut state income taxes by 10% for anyone making $100,000 a year or less.
And in an ad released last week, Walker is reminding voters of what he's done for their tax bills.
In fact, we actually got rid of the entire state property tax. That's right, 100% of the property taxpayers in the state saw a 100% reduction in their state property tax bill.
On the campaign trail, Walker's been warning that Evers' tax cut will result in increases elsewhere and that the state's gas tax would increase under the Democrat. But tax cuts may no longer be the reliable winner they have been in recent decades. Brookings Institution fellow Vanessa Williamson has looked at why Republicans nationally backed off talking about the federal tax cuts passed last December as midterm campaigns ramped up.
So what's been interesting is to see people being willing to take into consideration the possibility that you could raise taxes and just use the money for a good purpose. Often things like schools and health care are very popular.
The most recent Marquette Law School poll found 57% of Wisconsin voters favored increasing school spending over cutting taxes. Only 37% preferred a tax cut. Some of the state's voters did tell WPR reporters that lowering taxes and keeping them low is one of the most important issues for them this election season. But others fell into the camp that may no longer be strongly motivated by the promise of a tax cut. Amber Hatcher DeSayu says she's looking for something else from candidates in this election.
Whoever's going to protect my kids in school and whoever's going to do what's best for them, get our teachers the funding they need, get our teachers what they need to teach our kids. That's the most important thing to me.
And Brian Kovalkuski saw that summertime check as a political ploy.
It had little impact on me, but, you know, I think how that money could have been spent in other ways in the state would have been a lot more beneficial, whether it be, you know, roads or programs for youth or education.
Funding for roads and schools has also played prominently in the lead up to next week's election, when voters will either reward Walker's track record on taxes and spending or look for a new direction from Evers. Kyla Calvert-Mason, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can hear more of our election coverage at wisconsinvote.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, you may see a school funding referendum on your Election Day ballot. There are a lot of those around the state. We'll find out what's at stake. We'll look at the latest news on immigration and the politics surrounding it in our weekly roundup of national news. And we'll find out why it's tricky to forecast the weather, you know, over a three-month span, like a Wisconsin winter. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow after 6:15, the Milwaukee streetcar is swinging into action after years of development and some criticism. John Munson and his guests look at the impact of public transportation and what it means for a community tomorrow at 6:15 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. Then we'll talk about a new study that looks at the mismatch between people's education levels and the requirements for the jobs they have or that they're seeking. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.